Snap Studios.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Okay, so I briefly worked for the city of San Francisco. And my boss hates me with a passion. And I know this because she tells everyone that will listen that she hates me with a passion. So her supervisor, my boss's boss, decides that we all need to go out to lunch to clear the air. And I don't want to go. And my boss doesn't want to go. But you don't do what you want to do at work. So I walk over to the place, the rendezvous, the green zone, the sandwich spot. And I wait for them to arrive. And waiting and looking, I realize I've made a rookie mistake because I see my boss walking toward the spot with her boss, walking and talking and walking and talking. And when they finally arrive, from the gleam of triumph, the joy in my boss's eyes, I know that this lunch has just transformed from one person that hates me to two. Today on Snap Judgment, we proudly present Belly of the Beast. Amazing stories directly from the firing line. My name is Lynn Washington. Check please when you're listening to this. The Snap Judgment. Now then, Paul Templer. He grew up in Zimbabwe, and when he was in his 20s, Paul started working as a safari guide. To him, it was a dream job. And one of his favorite things was taking tourists out into the Zambezi River on something that he and fellow safari guides called the Royal Drift. Sensitive listeners should know this story does contain graphic imagery. Snap Judgment.
The idea was the clients get into the canoe. There's three seats, one in the middle, one in the front, one in the back. And their job is just to sit back, relax, and just enjoy being paddled down the mighty Zambezi River. You're in an armada of canoes. You're going down the Zambezi River. Just ahead of you, you've got Victoria Falls, the mist coming up off it. You're surrounded by some of the most incredible flora and fauna. Just the trees, the birds, the bugs, the animals. It's just beautiful out there. Loved it. Truly loved it. It was mandatory when we took clients out that we were armed. So I would have a gun, and I would usually have a hunting knife with me too. Because there's your ewes, the crocodiles, the hippos, there's snakes, scorpions, mosquitoes, lion, elephants, buffalo. One time we came across this guy who ran the safari camp, and we were talking about some of the huge crocs that we had seen. It turned out that they'd been having something of an issue with crocs. They'd been attacking and eating some of the local villagers, and so they'd started trying to trap some of the crocs. And there was one croc that kept on breaking their traps because it was too big. Ultimately, they managed to catch and destroy the croc. When they opened him up, there was almost the full body of one of the people who had been missing, but then there were bits and pieces of quite a few others. But what was strange, and I'm going to sound a little bit Looney Tunes here, the biggest danger for me when I was taking safari was, how were my clients going to react? Animals are incredibly tuned into the environment in so many ways. If there's someone with a lot of angst on a safari, if you had a client who was really scared, it was almost like it was a magnet for mayhem. We're going to draw to us what we're afraid of. I started as a safari guide when I was 22. And just a few years later, I opened my own safari company. It was awesome. We had our Land Rover and all our new equipment. It was just so freaking exciting. So we'd get the clients, and then it was time to give a safety talk. And the safety talk could be quite tricky because you didn't want to scare everyone. I'd say, listen, hippos are vegetarian, so they're not seeing you as a prospective meal. But you needed to make sure that they understood that out there in the wild, we were the intruders, and that there was always a chance that things could go horribly wrong. In Africa, hippos kill more people than any other animal. So it was just another one of those perfect days in Africa. And this was the inaugural trip. Everyone was seemingly having a pretty good time. They were just munching on their snacks and sipping on their drinks. Everything was going swimmingly well. And was crossing this channel when the back of my canoe just rose up off the water and then ever so gently tipped over, spilling us into the river. I'd been attacked by hippos before, and usually if they hit you, it's like this thud and you're bumped out of the canoe into the river. But on this particular trip, he was this incredibly large male hippo, and the behavior was odd. It's like snapping at the water, which again is unusual hippo behavior. So that was one of those crikey moments. We weren't far from the shore, so other than scaring the heck out of a few of us, he didn't really do that much damage to us. Word had spread like wildfire that this first trip of this new safari company had ended up with us getting attacked by hippos. So yeah, when I got back from that trip, I shared a house with a few fellow guides, and they see me walking up the driveway and I'm soaking wet and what have you. They ripped me mercilessly. They were like, way to go, Templar. Never going out with you. What was kind of interesting is the three guides who were sitting on the porch that afternoon making fun of me, all three of them ended up having run-ins with that very same hippo. A couple of weeks later, another group's on safari, only this time the attack's a little more intense. A couple of weeks later, another safari with another guide, a little more intense. And the intensity of the attacks ratcheted up. Up to a point, you felt bulletproof. But a few months later, I can remember sitting in a boat with a friend of mine. We were talking about, hey, you know how when you've used up all your lives, and we both had got to that point where you start doubting yourself. I remember waking up on the day in question, and things just seemed, I wouldn't say heavy, but there was definitely an edge to everything. I'd had weird premonitions to the extent that I'd gone out and figured out my life insurance, I got extra ammunition. I just knew all was not well. On that safari, the trip we were going on, there were three guides paddling. All three of them were apprentices. There was Ben and Evans. And then Mike came along. He was in a little one-man red kayak. We called it his little crocodile bait kayak. So we're just drifting down this narrow jungle line channel. It was dusk, and the world had that soft backlight that is just mesmerizing. We could see the top of the heads of a lot of male hippos dotted around all over the place. All it takes is an elephant to step out from the jungle and stand there with its huge ears fanning back and forth as you drift by to just make it an exceptional experience. So I remember us all just sitting there and taking a moment to soak in all that peace and tranquility when poof, there's this huge like thud behind me. And I turned just in time to see Evans, the paddler sitting in the back of the canoe that was behind us, flying through the air before he splashed to the river. the boat was so high up that I could see the top of a hippo beneath it. My mind sprung straight to crisis mode. First things first, I needed to make sure that everyone got to safety. Evans, the one guide, was now in the river. Ben, get everyone to safety! There was a cluster of rocks nearby, so he and Max started doing that. Evans, hang in there, I'm coming to get you. So I'm paddling towards Evans. Evans, come! Turning the boat, trying to get it into position, leaning over to grab a hold of him. And our fingers almost touch. It's like this made for Hollywood moment where I'm leaning, he's leaning. And then everything just went dark. A few very long seconds ticked by as I tried to figure out what was going on. You see, from my waist up, I wasn't dry, but I wasn't wet either, not like my legs were. And there was this incredible pressure crushing down on my lower back with my arms pinned to my sides. I can remember struggling to break free and it being like slimy, cavernous, and strangely quiet. I managed to move one hand around a little bit and I felt the bristles on a hippo's snout. I was head first, up to my waist, down the hippo's throat. I guess I must have been uncomfortable or wedged down his throat and all. So the hippo lets me go, and I burst to the surface. I take a lungful of fresh air, come face to face with Evans, the chap I'm trying to rescue, and I'm like, we got to get out of here. His eyes are like saucers as he struggles to stay afloat. And I was just moving in for the classic lifesaver's hold when, wham, I'm hit from below. Once again, I'm up to my waist down the hippo's throat, though this time my legs are trapped, my hands are free. One of the clients watching said it was like watching a vicious dog trying to rip apart a rag doll. He would throw me up into the air and I'd do this crazy sort of half twist and then he would catch me and bite down. And each time he bit down, it was so hard I thought for sure he was going to chop me in half. When he would go underwater, I'd hold my breath. When we were on the surface, I'd suck in air. And all the while, I'd hold on to these tusks that bore through me just so that my flesh didn't tear so much when he shook me about. But when I did that and I sucked in air, there was the smell of rotten eggs. The hippo was thrashing me about and I was desperately trying to get to my revolver, only I couldn't get a hold of the gun. Then things got really quite surreal. The hippo just went and dove for deep water and everything just went still. So I'm pinned inside his mouth and I remember lying at the bottom. We were probably in about 6 feet of water. And I'm looking up and all I can see are the different hues of green and yellow and I can see the sunlight shimmering on the water surface. And I just remember thinking, like, I wonder who can hold their breath the longest.
Find out when Snap Judgment returns the belly of the beast. Stay tuned. Support for Snap Judgment comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything. CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/snap. That's odoo.com/snap. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Belly of the Beast episode. When last we left, Paul Templer was at the bottom of the Zambezi River in the mouth of a hippo. Sensitive listeners should know this story does contain graphic imagery.
So I'm pinned inside his mouth, and I remember lying at the bottom. We were probably in about 6 feet of water. And I just remember thinking, like, I wonder who can hold their breath the longest. And I'm not sure how long we stayed there. But I can tell you that time passes very slowly when you're lying there in the jaws of a submerged hippo. After what seemed like an eternity, the hippo sprang towards the surface and flung me away yet again. This time when I broke surface and looked up, I saw the front of Mac's little red crocodile bait kayak. In just one of the most incredible demonstrations of bravery, Mac had paddled his kayak in and was trying to get me to safety. Held on for dear life as the hippo thrashed on me, thrashed on the boat, thrashed on Mac, and somehow, miracle of miracles, he managed to get us to this pile of rocks. And relative safety, the hippo couldn't get up onto the rocks. I remember getting to the rocks and looking across and counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All the clients were there. I was like, good. I remember trying to reassure them, all right, folks, you need to calm down. Everything's going to be okay. And them just looking at me. None of them could believe that I was still alive. I remember saying to Mac, where's Evans? And Mac just looking me square in the eye and going, he's gone, mate. He's gone. But again, my mind was in survival mode and it was, okay, we need to do X, Y, and Z. Okay, first aid kit, gun, radio, all gone. We've got a guy missing. I'm a hot mess. We've got 6 clients sitting on rocks in the middle of the crocodile-infested Zambezi River. And by the time anyone missed us and had mobilized a search and rescue team, it would be dark and their chances of finding us would be pretty slim. So my plan was, okay, load me into one of the canoes. Mac, you're going to stay here with the clients. Ben, you're going to paddle me. We're going to follow the current, and we can get to our extraction point and call in a rescue team. As I'm speaking, along with my words, blood starts bubbling out of my mouth. So Mac kind of half rolled me over, and he's like, oh, crikey. He could see basically part of my lung through a gaping hole in my back where a tusk had gone through. So he took the plastic cover from a tray of snacks, and he used that to seal the wound. It was incredible. He stopped my lung from collapsing and me from dying right there on the spot. He tore up his brand new jungle green safari shirt into thin strips, and he would stem the bleeding in some areas and tie off other areas. My one arm was so badly trashed. From the elbow up, it had been crushed to a pulp, and from the elbow down, the bone had been broken in so many places, and the skin, there was very little skin left on it. I think the technical term is degloved. But Mac figured out, okay, let's roll down your sleeve, button it up, and see if we can keep the arm attached. I remember getting loaded into the canoe, and he just eased the canoe out into the current. I'm lying in the canoe, and it's filling with a combination of my blood and more water, and the pain was just coming in waves. This is when death kind of started showing up. This hippo that's attacked us is toying with us. It's coming and bumping up against the canoe and making its little calls nearby. Each time it hits our boat, I get more and more terrified, and I'm saying to Ben, I can't do this again, Ben. And I want him to paddle fast. It feels like he's paddling in slow motion. And then I remember things just going really calm. This was a deeper, a more profound, a more surreal experience. It was a spiritual experience. There came this moment where I realized I had a choice. Do I shut my eyes and drift off and call it a day? Or do I fight my way through this and try to stick around? And it's not that I could see my life flashing before my eyes, but I just had the sense that there was more still to be done. I remember going, no, I'm going to stick around. We made it to the shore. And it turned out there was a medical air rescue team practicing less than 5 minutes away from me. They came beetling along thinking that it was part of a practice. And they took me into the hospital in the ambulance. I finally get to the hospital. It's 8 hours later. And they put me on this operating table. Big bright lights. I can't see anyone, but I can hear them. They're like talking about how my arms are barely still attached, how I'm going to lose limbs. Turns out I had 38 major bite wounds. I had a tusk go through my foot. The hippo tusk has gone through both my shoulders and separated them. My spine was open. My head was open. My face, it was not looking pretty. The doc comes up, and he told me the story later on. When he came in and he looked at all my injuries, the surgery that made sense was take off both of my arms and the bottom of one of my legs. That was probably going to have the best chance of me surviving. I looked him in the eye and I said to him, "Doc, I know that you're going to do what you got to do, but why do you say you take the minimalist approach?" Post-surgery, I can remember laying there and my eyes opening and being like kind of confused as to where I was. And I remember stealing myself and looking for my left hand because I knew that had been the side that had been hit the hardest. And I looked across and there was nothing there. There was no elbow. There was no forearm. There was no hand. There was no moving fingers. Even though I could feel them, it was all gone. And there was a lot of despair. It was was nauseating. And so I kept my eyes wide and I remember saying a prayer and then I looked and could see the fingers on my right hand and I moved them. I'm incredibly relieved. There's this like big cage over my legs and not a lot of movement coming from down there. I didn't want to look, but at the same time I needed to know what was left of me. The nurse who was in control, it was kind of like she could read my mind. So she went and with great aplomb, kind of like a magician, she just whipped back the sheet. And there at the bottom of each leg was 2 feet. And granted, the 1 foot was really mangled, but all of my toes were still attached. Evans, the chap who I was trying to save, they found his body 3 days after the attack. There wasn't a scratch on him. He drowned. I felt guilty because Evans, my guide, his safety and well-being had been my responsibility, and now he was dead. It was easy for me to blame the hippo. But as time went by, I got stronger, and I couldn't shake Dr. Nube's words. That's happened. I get to choose what happens next. I think the hippo almost became a talisman. Interesting part of the story, they never could find that hippo again. Gone, 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 gone. They spent days, weeks looking for him. Disappeared. Now, the river I'd been attacked on had never been canoed from source to sea. A lot of people had tried it, but to date, no one had succeeded. So I put together a team and I found someone who could build me a kayak paddle that I could strap onto one arm so I could paddle a kayak again. And about 2 years after my run-in with the hippo, set off leading what I hoped was going to be the first full descent of the Zambezi River. It was closing a loop. And about halfway down, we get to the point where the attack had happened. When out of the water comes this hippo, jaws agape, tearing straight at me, bites down in the water right next to me. I couldn't believe that this had happened again. And just saying, it was an abnormally large male hippo who looked surprisingly like the one who had attacked me 2 years earlier. He showed his teeth and he bit down on the water, but he did nothing more. He got the last word. No hippos have been seen in that area since.
Big thanks to Paul Templer for sharing his story. He wrote a book about his life called What's Left of Me, How I Lost a Fight with a Rogue Hippo and Won My Life. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That story, the original soundtrack, performed, composed, created by Renzo Gorio. The story was produced by Erica Lance. When Snap Judgment returns, know this. The first rule of Fight Club is that nobody talks about Fight Club. When the Snap Judgment Belly of the Beast episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Belly of the Beast episode. My name is Glenn Washington. Now, our next story comes to us from Ray Christian, and you've heard Ray on the Snap, but before Ray was Staff Sergeant Christian, he was just a kid living in a tough area called Churchill in Richmond, Virginia in the 1970s. Now, sensitive listeners should know, this story does contain graphic violence. Snap Judgment.
At our house, probably one of our favorite days of the week. And we didn't do much in common as a family. But on Saturday afternoons, my mama and my sister and I, we would look at wrestling on TV. It was like probably our biggest family event of the week. Our little 12-inch black and white television, we'd be almost in the screen. Our favorite wrestler at the time was Ric Flair. And the way he would stand up and go, woo, it used to just drive my mama crazy. We would just scream and holler, and I'd love to show my mom and my sister all my little wrestling moves. Wrestling was everything then. One day, after watching wrestling, me and my friend Jasper decided we'd go up to the park and burn off some energy and have some fun. Me and Jasper are walking up to the top of the hill to the flat spot, and as soon as we got over the top, we could see a couple of black guys. This in of itself wouldn't be unusual except for the fact they were so well-dressed. They were wearing leather jackets, nice shirts, bell-bottom pants, gold chains, sunglasses, smoking cigarettes, looking really cool. As soon as we noticed the guys, we also noticed a bunch of other kids there, too. There were probably about maybe 12 kids and all kind of mingling around. And they had this boxing bag, this punching bag, tied between two trees, and it's a guy, he's yelling and screaming at a group of the neighborhood kids, maybe about 15 guys standing around, and they're punching the bag, and he's screaming, punch it, come on, hit it, hit that bag, damn it. The guy in charge, he's kind of skinny, he's dark, he has scars on his face, and he's got a gold tooth, and he's wearing some small gold-rimmed glasses. He's got a big fro, and he's intense. And he keeps screaming things like, come on, punch that bag, hit it, damn it. Come on, damn it, be a man, hit the bag, punch it. One of the boys who was at the park watching was Dirty Red. Dirty Red is a light-skinned guy with a big, light brown afro. He's kind of skinny and tall. He's about 13 years old. And I saw him fight a lot in the neighborhood. I mean, he was fearless. Even the boys who were older than Dirty Red didn't mess with him. The guy points to Dirty Red, and he jumps in the center right away. And there's a kid standing there, and he said, you look good punching that bag. You ever tried that against a real person? And the kid stood up, and Dirty Red punched him in the nose real hard, and the boy fell over and started screaming, my nose, and blood immediately squirted out of it. And the man said, yeah, good job, good job. And the boy got up, started running off. And a couple of the guys started screaming at him,
You little coward, how you gonna be a man?
And with that, probably half the boys, maybe seven, all started to walk away at the same time as they were screaming at him.
Keep going, go ahead, go, leave.
So the guy in charge with the gold tooth, he looks at me and he says, hey, you wanna take a try? And I told him, I'm not good at boxing. He said, you ain't got to be able to box to be able to fight. Come on out here. And then he points me to another kid we call Blue. Now, Blue was probably somewhere between 12 to 14 years old. And he was really, really dark-skinned, and that's why we called him Blue. So me and Blue look at each other. And then it's on. And Blue was really, really strong. As soon as we made contact, he gave me a couple of punches. And I was in the fight of my life because he was really, really strong and powerful, and he could wrestle too. And we went on for probably 15 minutes to complete exhaustion. till we couldn't even pick our arms up anymore. And the man said, yeah, as you guys are good, you're a couple of badasses, you know. You could probably have a chance to make some money. And we couldn't really take that in right then because we were just happy and wanting to do something, thinking it was fun. Until he said, you know, we can meet back again here at the park maybe in a week or so. Come pick you up. I'm going to take you somewhere, get you $5 and 2 Coca-Colas. How'd that sound to you? I said, man, that sounds good. Now, the last kid I didn't mention besides me, Dirty Red and Blue, was a kid named Crazy Kevin. He was the kind of kid that when we were in middle school, he bit a teacher till she bled. He'd fight children, he'd fight adults, he'd fight animals, especially dogs. I remember they spent a long period of time trying to explain to him what was happening, and then finally they said, like, the hell with it. His crazy ass will work anyway. It don't matter. So I was worried about who in my mind, which of the group of us I would have to fight. I did have the idea in my head that it would be other kids I wouldn't know, plus these kids I did know. Or maybe there was a chance that we might be fighting as a team of something. When the guys told us that we were going to meet in a week, they did kind of let us know that you don't need to tell a lot of people about it. In fact, don't tell anybody about it. But we were still kids. I mentioned it to Jasper. Jasper was trying to tell me, don't do it. It didn't feel right. It didn't look right. It felt funny. Who's going to pay you to fight anyway? Did you ask him that? And I told him, the man said, lots of people want to see that, you know. People go to see kung fu movies, don't they? And he was going, I don't know, man. I don't know who would do that. I said, man, you just scared probably yourself. We kind of separated after that during the week. I thought about telling my mama exactly what I was going to do. And I wasn't the kind of kid that could lie to my mama like that. But for some reason, as preposterous as it even sounded, that I would be going across town to see my sister, she said, okay, okay. The day comes, I walk up to the park, and I'm kind of dancing around, flexing my muscles, doing the things that I think fighters would do prior to a fight. Dirty Red is already there. Blue shows up. Crazy Kevin is really late, and the guy's getting kind of pissed off because we're already in the car. Nice, big old deuce and a quarter. Roomy. Leather seats in the back. They were so smooth, they were almost slippery. None of our family's parents had a car anyway. We weren't really used to being in cars, and it smelled nice. It felt like style. Now, he said to us it was going to be a club, but the place that we were driving in, I recognized it immediately as one of the run-down industrial parts of the city. It doesn't look like the kind of place where people would be clubbing. But we stop in front of this one building, and there's about 30 or more cars outside. And we watch groups of people get out of cars, pull up, go inside. There were women dressed up. People were drinking beer outside, smoking outside, and people were going in. The guys get out of the car, and they tell us, you stay right here, don't you leave. But here's your first Coke. And they give us the Cokes and the bottles, and they were cold, and they burned our throats when we were drinking them fast because we weren't used to drinking sodas, and it was so refreshing, and we were really pumped up. Then it's now starting to become dark outside, and it feels exciting. Flashes of different lights. Women's lipsticks looks redder than red. Everybody looks fancy. You can smell cologne, aftershave, and perfume. So the guy comes out, and he tells us, come on, get out. And as we're standing at the door before we go in, the guy opens the door, and he kind of pushes us in. We don't have a chance to walk in. We were perfectly willing to run in if we had to. We were so excited. But he's pushing us, and that in itself is odd. And as soon as we get inside, there must be 100 people in there. All adults, making a lot of noise, screaming, just having a good time. We look to our left, and we notice the whole crowd. There's a crowd in there, but to the left, there are about 8 guys. They are big, and they are strong and muscular. They were taking sips of beer. We are 4 little hairless chests, little brown boys. None of us are wearing real athletic shorts, old dungarees, dirty t-shirts, still had grass stains in them. And we looked behind us to say, who are the guys that they're gonna fight? And I'm sure that's what Dirty Red thought, because he was dancing around and holding his hands up, and he didn't look as afraid. When the man said something to him and whispered in his ear and pushed him in the center, Red ran right out there and started dancing right around. One of the muscular guys standing there in the group of about eight, he's about 6 foot tall, maybe 200 pounds. You could see his body sweating and his muscles flexing. He takes a sip of beer and wipes his mouth. He got a crazy grin on his face and he walks out to meet Dirty Red in the center. The guy picks him up and throws him through the crowd, and his body slapped the wall and slid down. And he never picked up his hands again. He tried picking him up by his pants so he could punch him in his face, but Dirty Red was just limp. He dropped him back down and the crowd started screaming, stump, 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 stump. And with the encouragement of the crowd, he stomped on Dirty Red 4 or 5 times. And some other guy came up and grabbed him by his britches and dragged him to the door and dropped him. As soon as I saw that, me and the other two boys immediately were trying to say, no, we want to go home now. I want to go. We want to go. But nobody could hear us, and we were saying it really loud because it was so loud. And then it was my turn. And the man looks at me, and he said, come on. And I don't move. And he's pushing me, and my feet are sliding through the trash and bits of concrete on the floor and pieces of broken glass, and I'm going, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I want to go home. And he said, go, go. And he pushes me. And I look at the guy. He's smiling, and he gives me this kind of oh shucks look on his face, like it's going to be all right. And he walks up to me nice and slowly, and he punches me in the stomach as hard as I have ever been hit. For a moment, I couldn't remember how to breathe. And I dropped right to the floor, and I was trembling. He kicked me in the face a couple of times. Just flashes of light. I was so close to the floor, I could see people jumping up and down. As beat up as I was, I reached out my hand and I tried to wipe the pieces of broken glass away because I didn't want to have my face cut anymore. And I felt a huge stomp to my back. And then I just faded to black. I don't know what happened to Crazy Kevin, and I don't know what happened to Blue. But when I got to a point where I could regain some consciousness, we were all outside on the ground. And the man was grabbing on us and slapping us, saying, get up, get in the car. All of us were moaning. The man yelled at us to shut up. I heard somebody in the pack say, my teeth are gone. The man said, shut the hell up. Here's your Coke. He was trying to hand us the Cokes in the back. We could hardly reach for them. I put the Coke bottle to my mouth and it just burned my busted lip. I couldn't drink it. I was spilling Coke on the back of the car and he yelled at me for that. The hell you think you're doing? A couple of the other boys cried too. And at some point, Crazy Kevin stopped making sounds altogether. That ride back to Church Hill seemed like it took forever. Every pebble on the street, every stop, every pause hurt. They dropped us off at the park. We got our $5 too. And I can remember all of us laid down in the grass after they drove off. And it probably took 20 minutes for each of us, one at a time, started to get up and head home. I was the last one. It was only about 3 blocks but it took me maybe an hour. I laid on the front porch and I cried for about a half an hour. Every sniffle hurt. The snot and the blood in my nose were all mixed together, and I had a big clump, bloody clot that I blew out. I beat on the door for a little while, and Mama came to the door and said, "What happened to you?" I said, I fell down. She said, "You're lying. Let's get you in the house." And as soon as she touched me, it should have hurt really bad, but it was something about my mama touching me that made me feel safe. She wiped me and she put cold rags on me. I didn't go to school for 3 or 4 days. It was weeks before I ever went back to the park again. But yeah, I saw him again. It was the same setup. The rope, the punching bag, the guys looking cool. Different group of kids, different faces, but the same little general attitudes. "Come on, punch this thing. You can do it. Come on. Come on. You're a punk? Are you scared?" As soon as I see the kids in the park punching the bag, my body gets all tense and the hair on the back of my head rises up and I'm thinking, I want to run. I want to run and I want to tell them to run too. Run, get the hell out of here right now. You don't have no idea. There's no club. There's no fighting contest. I want to say that. But I don't say that. We don't say that where I was growing up. Your parents got to say that. And I do turn around and I'm walking fast. You would think that they were chasing me out of the park when they probably never noticed me at all. They never paid any attention to me. They weren't watching me. They didn't even see me there. That was years ago. I was that afraid. No, I wasn't going to tell. My family was too small. They weren't vicious enough. They weren't criminal enough to form some vigilante party and go to the other side of town and find this guy and kill him and beat him. We were like at the bottom of the food chain. There were probably black middle-class people that never had to experience that. But even in our community, people like me, a family where my folks were the poorest of the poor and the least educated among uneducated and poor people, nobody cared about us. We were low priority. Call the police? Never. They weren't there for us. They didn't take care of things like that, and we all knew that. That was just asking for trouble. It never even occurred to us to even do anything like that. So I'm about 25 years old. I'm a staff sergeant in the Army assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, and we've been deployed to Panama to do some jungle operations training. My unit is bivouacked near this small village in Panama, and as usual, the guys were in the habit of collecting their candy. The local kids liked it, and every MRE, every meal that we ate in the field, all of our rations had some type of chocolate. So the guys started gathering the candy together, and the local kids were walking around, and initially they started giving kids candy, and then more kids started to come, and they started throwing candy, and the kids started running around chasing each other for it, and the kids started pushing each other. And the guys started throwing candy out in such a way that the kids had to compete and fight for it. And then the guys started yelling and screaming and encouraging the kids. And the kids started fighting and wrestling. And I just went off. And I went, whoa, stop. No, don't throw the damn candy at the kids. Don't make the kids fight for the candy. You give them kids that candy. And the guys were like, "Okay, Sarge. Okay. Here, kids, you can have the candy." "What's wrong with Sergeant Christian?" "Man, he don't have no sense of humor." "No, I don't have any sense of humor when it comes to that. And I don't now."
Big thanks to Ray Christian. Dr. Ray Christian. Hear more of Ray on his podcast, What's Ray Saying? We're going to have a link to All That Is Ray and more at snapjudgment.org. The original score by Renzo Gorio. The story was produced by Mark Ristich. This is not the news. No Oasis news. In fact, you could put your head into the hippo's maw for the big finale, only to realize that you forgot to feed him today. Whoops. And it would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is PRX.